Ain't strong or no, I can't imagine Elias standing by for long, while Joshua builds power here in the north. But I thought Prince Joshua didn't want to be king, Simon said. And he doesn't. But Elias is not the type to understand that. Ambitious men never believe others aren't the same. He's also got priorities, whispering words of snaky advice in his ear. But haven't Joshua and the king been enemies for years? Since long before priorities came? Sangfugal nodded. There has been no shortage of trouble between them. They loved each other once. Were closer than most brothers, or so I'm told by Joshua's older retainers. But they fell out. And then Hylissa died. Hylissa? Simon asked. Elias Nabonae's wife. Joshua was bringing her to Elias, who was still a prince, at war then for his father in the Thrythings. Their party was waylaid by Thrythings raiders. Joshua lost his hand trying to defend Hylissa. But to no avail. The raiders were too many. Simon let out a long breath. So that's how it happened. It was the death of any love between them, or so people say. After thinking for a while on Sangfugal's words, Simon stood and stretched. The sore spot on his ribs gave him a warning twinge. So what will Prince Joshua do now? He asked. The harper scratched at his arm and stared down at the commons yard. I can't even guess, Sangfugal said. Prince Joshua is cautious and slow to action. Anyway, they don't usually call me in to discuss strategy. He smiled. There is talk that important emissaries are arriving, and that sometime within a sennight, Joshua will call a formal raid. A what? Raid. It's an old Erkinlandish term for council, more or less. People in these parts tend to cling to the older ways. Out in the country, away from the castle, most of them still use the old speech. A Hayholt man like yourself would probably need a local interpreter. Simon would not be distracted by talk of rustic foibles. A council, you said, a raid? Would that be a council of war? These days, the musician replied, and his face was again somber. Any council at Naglamund will be a council of war. They walked along the battlements. I'm surprised, Sangfugal said, that with all the services you have rendered to my master, he has not yet called you for an audience. I've only just got out of bed this morning, Simon said. Besides, he may not even have known it was me, in a dark clearing, with a dying giant and all. I suppose you're right, the harper said, clinging to his hat, which was doing its best to take to the gusting winds. Still, Simon thought, if Maria took him the message from the princess, I should hope she would mention her companions. I never would have thought she was the kind of girl to just forget us. He had to be fair, though. What girl suddenly saved from the damp and dangerous wilderness would not prefer to spend her time with the gentlefolk of the castle instead of a stringy scullion? You haven't by any chance seen the girl Maria who came with us? He asked. Sangfugal shook his head. People are coming in at the gates every day. And not just the ones fleeing the outlying farms and villages either. The outriders for Prince Gwythyn of Hernesteer came in last night. Horses in a lather. The prince's party should be here this evening. Lord Ethelfirth of Tynset has been here for a week with 200 men. Baron Ordmere brought 100 Utasol men just after. Other lords are coming in with their musters from all around. The hunt is afoot, Simon, though the Aedan only knows who's hunting who. They had reached the northeastern turret. Sangfugal tipped a salute to the young soldier who was walking sentry. Beyond his grey-cloaked shoulder rose the bulk of the Weald Helm, the massive hills seeming close enough to reach out and touch. Busy as he is, the harper said suddenly, It doesn't seem right that he shouldn't have seen you yet. Do you mind if I put in a word for you? I'm to attend him at dinner tonight. I would certainly like to see him, yes. I was very frightened for his safety, and my master gave a great deal so that Joshua could return here, to his home. Simon was surprised to notice a faint touch of bitterness in his own voice. He hadn't meant it to sound that way, but still, he had gone through it here, and it had been him and no other who had found Joshua, trussed and hanging like a pheasant over a cotsman's doorway. The tone of the remark had not escaped Sangfugel either. The look he turned on Simon was compounded of sympathy and amusement. I understand. I would advise, however, that you do not put it to my prince in quite that manner. He is a proud, difficult man, Simon, but I'm sure he hasn't forgotten you. Things have been, as you know, rather difficult of late in these parts, almost as harrowing as your own journey. Simon lifted his chin and stared out at the hills, at the strange shimmer of the wind-ruffled trees. I know, he said. If he can see me, it will be an honor. If he cannot, well, that is what will be. The harper grinned lazily, playful eyes drooping at the corners. A proud and fair speech. Come now, let me show you the nails of Naglamund. It was truly an astonishing sight in broad daylight. The field of shining poles, starting within a few ells of the ditch below the eastern wall of the castle, slanted up the slope and away for perhaps a quarter of a league, right up to the feet of the hills. They were arranged in symmetrical rows, as though a legion of spearmen had been buried there, leaving only their weapons protruding above the dark soil to show how conscientiously they stood their guard. The road that meandered down from a gaping cavern in the hill's western face wound back and forth between the rows as sinuously as the track of a serpent, stopping at last before the Naglamund's heavy eastern gate. And whatever was his name did all this because he was frightened of the Scythi? Simon asked, bewildered by the strange, silvery dark crop that stretched before him. Why not just put them at the top of the wall? Duke Swades was his name. He was Naben's governor here, and he was breaking precedent to place his castle on Scythi lands. As to why not on the walls? Well, I suppose he feared they could find some way to get over a single wall, or beneath, perhaps. This way, they would need to go through them. You have not seen the half, Simon. These things used to sprout on every side. Sangfugel swung his arm in an encompassing gesture. What did the Scythi do? Simon asked. Did they try an attack? Sangfugel frowned. Not as I've ever heard. You should really ask old Father Strangyard about that. He is the archivist and historian of the place. Simon smiled. I've met him. Interesting old scuffer, isn't he? He told me once that when Aswides built this place, the Scythi called it, damn, I should know these old stories being a balladeer. Anyway, the name they had for it meant something like trap that catches the hunter, as if Aswides had just walled himself in or some such. That he had made his own trap. And did he? What happened to him? Sangfugel shook his head and nearly lost his hat again. Damn me if I know. Probably got old and died here. I don't think the Scythi paid much attention to him. It took them an hour to complete the circuit. They had long ago emptied the jar of beer Sangfugel had brought to wash down their meal, but the harper had prudently brought a skin of wine as well, thus saving them from a dry hike. They were laughing. The older man was teaching Simon a bawdy song about a Nabene noblewoman when they reached the main gate and the winding stairs back down to the ground. As they emerged from the gatehouse, they found themselves in a milling crowd of workmen and soldiers. Most of the latter were off duty, to judge by the disarray of their dress. Everyone was shouting and shoving. Simon quickly found himself crushed between a fat man and a bearded guardsman. "What's happening?" he called to Sangfugel, who had been pulled a short distance away by the movement of the crowd. "I'm not sure," the other called back. "Perhaps Gwythyn of Hernisadark has arrived." The fat man turned his red face up to Simon. "No, it ain't," he said cheerfully. His breath stank of beer and onions. "It's that giant, the one what the prince has killed." He pointed toward the pyre, which still stood naked at the edge of the commons. "But I don't see the giant," Simon said.
"They're just a-fetching him," the man said. "I just came with the others to make sure of seeing. My sister's son was one of the beaters. What helped catch the devil beast?" he added proudly.
Now another wave of sound passed through the crowd. Somebody up front could see something, and the word was hurrying back to those who could not. Necks were craned, and children were lifted to the shoulders of patient, dirty-faced mothers. Simon looked around. Sangfugel had disappeared. He stood up on tiptoe and found that only a few in the throng were as tall as he. Beyond the pyre, he saw the bright silks of a tent or awning, and before it the flashing colours of some of the castle's courtiers, sitting on stools and talking, waving their sleeves as they gestured, like a branch full of brilliant birds. He scanned the faces for a glimpse of Maria. Perhaps she had already found a noble lady to attach herself to. Surely it was not safe for her to go back to the princess at the Hayholt, or wherever she was. None of the faces was hers, however, and before he could look for her elsewhere in the assemblage, a line of armored men appeared in one of the archways of the inner wall. Now the crowd was murmuring in earnest. For the first half dozen soldiers were followed by a team of horses pulling a high wooden cart. Simon felt a moment of hollowness in his stomach, but dismissed it. Was he to go all queasy every time a wagon creaked by? As the wheels ground to a halt, and the soldiers gathered around to unload the pale thing humped high on the bed of the cart, Simon caught a glimpse of crow-black hair and white skin over where the noble stood, beyond the stacked timbers. When he looked closer, hoping it was Maria, the laughing courtiers had closed in again, and there was nothing to see. It took 8 straining guardsmen to lift the pole on which the giant's body hung, like a deer from the king's hunting preserve. And even so, they still had to slide it from the wagon to the ground before they could get their shoulders comfortably under the bar. The creature had been trussed at knees and elbows. Huge hands wagged in the air as its back bumped along the ground. The crowd, which had pushed forward eagerly, now began to fall back with exclamations of fear and disgust. The thing looked more manlike now, Simon thought, than when it had loomed upright before him in the forest of the Steeler, with the skin of its dark face gone slack in death. The menacing snarl erased, it wore the puzzled expression of a man given unfathomable news. As Strangyard had said, it wore a garment of rough cloth around its waist. A belt of some reddish stones hung dragging in the dust of the commons. The fat man beside Simon, who had been exhorting the soldiers to march faster, turned a merry eye his way.
"Do you know what he was a-wearing round his neck?" he shouted.
Simon, hemmed in on both sides, shrugged.
"Skulls,"
the man said, as pleased as if he had given them to the dead giant himself.
"Wearing 'em as a necklace he was, giving 'em an Aedonite burial, the princes, even though it's anyone's guess whose they be."
He turned back to the spectacle again. Several other soldiers had climbed to the top of the pyre and were helping the bearers move the massive creature into place. When they had wrestled it into place, lying on its back at the summit, they slipped the pole out from between its crossed arms and legs and scrambled down in a group. As the last man leaped down to the ground, the great body slipped forward a little way, and the sudden movement made a woman scream. Several children began to cry. A grey-cloaked officer shouted an order. One of the soldiers leaned forward and thrust a torch deep into the bundles of straw that had been laid around the edges. The flames, strangely colourless in the late afternoon sun, began to bend around the straw, reaching upward toward more substantial food. Wisps of smoke twined around the form of the giant, and some current of air bent his shaggy fur like dry summer grass. There! He had seen her again, beyond the pyre. Trying to push forward, he received a sharp elbow to the ribs from someone fighting to retain their choice viewpoint. He stopped, frustrated, and stared at the spot where he thought he had spotted her. Then he saw, and he realized it was not Maria. This black-haired woman, wrapped in a somber, exquisitely sewn green cloak, was perhaps 20 years older. She was certainly beautiful, though, with ivory skin and wide, up-tilted eyes. As Simon stared, she in turn watched the burning giant, whose hair was beginning to curl and blacken as the fire climbed the mound of pine logs. The smoke rose like a curtain, obscuring her from Simon's view. He wondered who she was, and why, as the Naglamundas all around shouted and waved their fists at the pillar of smoke, she looked into the blaze with such sad, angry eyes. Chapter 31. The Councils of the Prince. Although he had been quite hungry while walking the castle walls with Sangfugel, when Father Strangyard came by to take him to the kitchens, belatedly fulfilling his earlier promise, Simon found that his appetite had fled. The stench of the afternoon's burning was still in his nostrils. He could almost feel the clinging smoke as he walked behind the castle archivist. As they walked back across the misty commons, after Simon had picked ineffectually at a plate of bread and sausages, thumped down before him by a stern kitchen woman, Strangyard did his best to make conversation.
"Perhaps you're just tired, lad."
"Yes, that's what it will be.
Appetite should be back in no time. Young people always have an appetite."
"I'm sure you're right, Father," Simon said. He was tired, and it was easier sometimes to agree with people than to explain. Besides, he was not entirely sure himself what was making him feel so limp, so washed out. They walked on a while through the twilight inner ward.
"Oh," the priest said at last, "I was meaning to ask you. I hope you don't think it's grasping of me."
"Yes?"
"Well, Binnebik, that is, he told me of a certain manuscript, a manuscript penned by Dr. Morganis of Herchester. Such a great man. Such a tragic loss to the community of learning."
Strangyard shook his head sorrowfully, then seemed to forget what he had been asking, for he walked several more steps in gloomy contemplation. Simon at last felt compelled to break the silence.
"Dr. Morganis' book?" he prompted.
Oh, yes. Well, what I wish to ask was, and I'm sure it is too great a favor, Binbinis said it was saved, the manuscript, that it came with you in your pack."
Simon hid a smile. The man took forever.
"I don't know where the pack is."
"Oh, it's under my bed. Your bed, that is, for now. As long as you want, actually. I saw the prince's man put it there. I haven't touched it, I assure you," he hastened to add.
"Do you want to read it?"
Simon was touched by the old man's earnestness.
"By all means, I am too tired to look at it. Besides, I am sure the doctor would prefer it to be examined by a man of learning, which is certainly not me."
"Truly?"
Strangyard seemed dazzled, fidgeting nervously with his eye patch. He looked as though he might pull it off and throw it into the air with a whoop of glee.
"Oh," the priest breathed, composing himself. "That would be splendid."
Simon felt uncomfortable. The archivist had, after all, moved out of his own room so that Simon, a stranger, could use it. It was embarrassing that he should be so grateful.
"Ah," he decided, "but it's not me he's grateful to, I don't think, so much as it is the chance to read Morgani's work on King John. This is a man who loves books the way Rachel loves soap and water."
They had almost reached the low block of rooms along the southern wall when a shape appeared, a man unrecognizable in the fog and fast diminishing light.
He made a faint clinking noise as he stepped in front of them.
"I'm searching for the priest Strangyard," the man said, his voice more than a little slurred. He seemed to waver, and the clinking noise came again. "He is I," Strangyard said, a little more highly pitched than usual. That is, I am he. What is your business?" "I seek a certain young man," the other said, and took a few steps closer. "Is this him?" Simon tensed his muscles, but could not help noticing that the approaching figure was not very big. Also, there was something about his walk. "Yes." Simon and Strangyard spoke together, then the priest fell silent, plucking distractedly at his head strap as Simon continued. "I'm the one. What do you want?"
"The prince wants to speak with you,"
the small figure said, closing to within a few feet, peering up at Simon. He jingled faintly.
"Towser," Simon said happily. "Towser, what are you doing here?"
He reached out and clamped his hands on the old man's shoulders.
"Who are you, then?"
the jester said, startled.
"Do I know you?"
"I don't know. I'm Simon, Dr. Morgani's apprentice, from the Hayholt."
"Hmm,"
the jester said doubtfully. Up close, he smelled of wine.
"I suppose so. It's dim to me, lad, dim. Towser is getting old, like old King Tathtane. Head snow-capped and weathered like distant Minari Mount," he squinted, "and I'm not so sharp with faces as once I was. Are you the one I'm to take to Prince Joshua?"
"I suppose."
Simon's mood had lifted.
"Senfugel must have spoken to him."
He turned to Father Strangyard.
"I must go with him. I haven't moved that pack. Didn't even know it was there."
The archivist mumbled an acknowledgement and scuttled off in quest of his prize. Simon took the elbow of the old jester as they turned back across the commons yard.
"Whoosh,"
said Towser, shivering. The bells on his jacket tinkled again.
"Sun was high today, but the wind is bitter tonight. Bad weather for old bones. Can't think why Joshua sent me."
He staggered a bit, leaning for a moment on Simon's arm.
"That's not true, really," he continued. "He likes to give me things to do. He's not much for my jesting and tricks, you see. But I don't think he likes to see me idle."
They walked on for a while without speaking.
"How did you get to Naglamond?" Simon asked at last.
"Last wagon caravan up the Wealdelm Road. Elias has closed it now, the dog. Rough travelling it was, too. Had to fight off bandits north of Flett. Everything's falling apart, boy. Everything's going sour."
The guards at the front of the residence hall scrutinized them carefully in the flickering torchlight, then knocked for the door to be unbolted. Simon and the jester padded down the cold, flagstone corridor until they reached another heavy-beamed door and another pair of guards.
"Here you are, boy," Towser said. "I'm off to bed. Had a late night last night. It's good to see a familiar face. Come by soon and have a noggin with me. Tell me what you've been up to. Yes?"
He turned and shuffled off down the hallway, the patchwork of his motley glimmering faintly until he was swallowed by shadows. Simon stepped up between the impassive guards and rapped on the door.
"Who goes there?"
a boy's voice asked.
"Simon of Hayholt to see the prince."
The door swung silently in to reveal a solemn-faced child of about 10 years, dressed in the costume of a page. When he stepped out of the way, Simon moved past him into a curtained antechamber.
"Come through,"
a muffled voice called. After some searching, he found the entrance, hidden by a curtain. It was an austere room, scarcely better furnished than Father Strangyard's. Prince Joshua, in gown and nightcap, sat at a table holding a scroll open with his elbow. He did not look up as Simon entered, but waved toward another chair.
"Please, sit down," he said, arresting Simon halfway into a deep bow. "I will be a moment only."
As Simon sat in the hard, unpadded chair, he saw a movement at the back of the room. A hand pulled the curtain there aside, revealing a sliver of lamplight beyond. A face appeared, dark-eyed, framed in thick black hair. The woman he had seen in the courtyard, watching the burning. She was looking intently at the prince, but when she looked up, her stare met Simon's and held it, angry eyes like a cornered cat. The curtain dropped back into place. Worried, for a moment he considered saying something to Joshua. A spy? An assassin? Then he realized why this woman was in the prince's bedchamber, and he felt very foolish. Joshua looked up to the blushing Simon, allowing the scroll to curl on the table before him. "Now forgive me," he rose and pulled his chair nearer. "I have been thoughtless. I hope you will understand that I meant no slight to one who helped me escape my imprisonment." "No, no need to apologize, Your Highness," Simon stammered. Joshua spread the fingers of his left hand, a pained expression on his face. Simon remembered what Sengfugel had said and wondered what it must be like to lose a hand. "Please, Joshua, in this room. Prince Joshua, if you must. When I studied with the Osirian brothers in Naban, they called me Acolyte, or Boy. I do not think I have come so far since then."
"Yes, sir."
Joshua's eyes flicked away back to his writing table. In the moment of silence, Simon looked him over carefully. In truth, he did not look a great deal more princely than when Simon had seen him in his shackles in Morgaini's chambers. He looked tired, worn by care, as surely as a rock is worn by weather. In his night clothes, high pale brow furrowed in thought, he looked more like a companion archivist to Father Strangyard than a prince of Erkinland or a son of Prester John. Joshua got up and walked back to his scroll. "The writings of Dendinus." He tapped it against his leather-capped right wrist. "Aswide's military architect. Do you know Naglamund has never been broken by siege? When Fingal of Rimmer's guard rolled down from the north, he had to detach 2,000 men to keep this castle bottled up, to protect his flank." He tapped again. "Dendinus built well." There was a pause. At length Simon awkwardly filled it. "It is a mighty keep, Prince Joshua." The prince tossed the scroll back onto the table, pursing his lips like a miser counting out his taxes. "Yes, but even a mighty keep can be starved out. Our supply lines are almost impossibly long. And where can we expect to find help?" Joshua looked at Simon as if he expected some answer. But the youth could only goggle without a thought of what to say. "Perhaps this Grimnor will bring back cheering news," the prince continued, "and perhaps not. Word is spreading up from the south that my brother is assembling a great force of troops." Joshua stared at the floor, then looked up suddenly, eyes bright and intent. "Again, forgive me. I find I am awash in dark thoughts lately, and my words run ahead of my good sense. It is one thing to read of great battles, you know. It is another to try and plan them. Do you know how many things there are to think of? Mustering the local troops, bringing the people and their stock into the castle, foraging, shoring up the walls. And all these things useless if no one will fight at Elias' back. If we stand alone, we will stand a long time. But we will fall at last." Simon was disconcerted. It was flattering to have Joshua speak so openly with him, but there was also something frightening about a prince so full of foreboding. A prince who was willing to speak to a boy as though to his war council. "Well," Simon said at last, "well, surely everything will turn out as God wills it." He hated himself for such stupidity, even as the words were out of his mouth. Joshua only laughed, a sour chuckle. "Ah, caught up by a mere lad, like Osiris on the famous thorn bush. You are right, Simon. While we breathe, there's hope. And I have you to thank for that.
Only in part, Prince Joshua?
Did that sound ungrateful, he wondered. The wintry look returned to the prince's stern face.
I heard about the doctor. A cruel blow to us all. But even crueler to you, I'm sure.
We will miss his wisdom.
His goodness too, but his wisdom more. I hope that others can take up some of the slack.
Joshua pulled up the chair again and leaned forward.
There will be a council, and I think it must be soon. Gwythyn, Luther of Hernesty's son, will be here tonight. There are already others who have been waiting several days. Many plans hinge on what we decide here. Many lives.
Joshua nodded his head slowly, musing.
Is Duke Iskrimnor alive, Prince?
Simon asked.
I spent a night with his men on the journey here, but I left them.
He and his men were here days ago, stopping before continuing toward Elric's Hala. That is why I cannot wait. They might be weeks.
He looked away again.
Can you wield a sword, Simon?
He asked suddenly. Have you been trained?
Not really, sir.
Then go to the captain of the guards and have him find someone to work with you. We will need every arm, I think. Especially strong young ones.
Of course, Prince Joshua, Simon said.
The prince stood up and walked to his table, turning his back as though the audience was over. Simon sat frozen in his chair, wanting to ask another question, not sure of the propriety. At last, he stood up too, and backed slowly toward the curtained doorway. Joshua continued to stare at Dendina's scroll. Simon was a step from going out when he stopped, squared his shoulders, and asked the question he had been balancing.
"Prince Joshua, sire," he began,
and the tall man looked back over his shoulder.
"Yes? Did the girl Maria, the girl who brought you the message from your niece Miriamel?"
He took her breath.
"Do you know where she is?"
Joshua raised an eyebrow. "Even in our darkest days, we cannot keep our minds from them, can we?" The prince shook his head.
"I'm afraid I cannot help you there, young man."
"Good night."
Simon bobbed his head and backed out through the curtain.
As he walked back from his unsettling audience with the prince, Simon wondered what would become of them all. It had seemed such a victory to reach Naglamund. For weeks he had thought of no other goal, followed no other star. Torn away from his home, it had been something to pursue to keep the larger questions at bay. Now, what had seemed a paradise of safety compared to the wild journey was suddenly yet another trap. Joshua had as much as said it. If they were not overrun, they would be starved. As soon as he reached Strangyard's tiny room, he crawled into bed, but he heard the sentries call out the hour twice more before he fell asleep. A groggy Simon answered the rap at the door, opening it to discover a grey morning, a large wolf, and a troll.
"I am startled to be finding you abed,"
Binnebik grinned wickedly.
"A few days out of the wilderness only, and civilization has sunk its claws of laziness into you."
"I am not," Simon frowned, "in bed, not any longer. But why aren't you?"
"In bed?"
Binnebik asked, stumping slowly into the room and nudging the door closed with his hip.
"I am better, or better enough. Things there are to do."
He squinted around the room as Simon sank back onto the edge of the pallet and contemplated his own unshod feet.
"Do you know where is the pack we saved?"
the troll asked at last.
Simon grunted, then waved his hand at the floor. "It was under the bed, but I think Father Strangyard took it to get Morgaini's book."
"Likely it is still there,"
Binnebik said, lowering himself gingerly to his hands and knees.
"The priest seems to me a man forgetful of people, but who is putting things back in their place when he is finished with them?"
He scrabbled under the bed.
"Aha! Here I have found it."
"Isn't that bad? With your wound?"
Simon asked, feeling guilty he had not offered to do it himself. Binnebik backed out and stood up, very carefully, Simon noticed.
Trolls have fast healing, he said, and smiled broadly.
But Simon was still worried.
I don't think you should be up and around yet, he said as Binnebik rifled through the pack. That's no way to get better.
A fine troll mother you would make, Binnebik said without looking up. Will you be chewing my meat for me, too? Ginkeeper, where are those bones?
Simon got down on his knees to try and find his boots, but it was difficult with the wolf padding up and down in the narrow chamber.
Can't Kantaka wait outside? He asked as a broad flank bumped him again.
Both of your friends will be happy to leave if we are bringing you inconvenience, Simon,
the troll said primly.
Ay-ya! Here, they have been hiding.
Outdone, the boy stared at the troll. Binnebik was brave, clever, kind, had been wounded at Simon's side, and even without these things was anyway too little to hit. Simon made a noise of disgust and frustration and crawled over.
What do you need those bones for?
He peered over Binnebik's shoulder.
Is my arrow still there?
The arrow, yes, his friend replied. The bones? Because these are days of decision, and I would be a fool to avoid any wise advising.
The prince summoned me last night.
I know.
Binnebik shook the bones out of their sack and weighed them in his hand.
I was speaking with him this morning. The Hernestiri have arrived. They will be cancelled tonight.
He told you that?
Simon was more than a little disappointed to find that he had not been Joshua's only confidant, but a little relieved as well to find the responsibility shared.
Are you going to go there?
As the only man of my people ever to enter the walls of Naglimund, as the apprentice of Oke Cook, singing man of the Minterhawk Trolls? Of course I will go. So also will you.
Me?
He felt caught off balance.
Why, me? What in the name of the good God would I do at a military council? I'm no soldier. I'm not even a grown man.
Certain it is. You are not hurrying to be one.
Binnebik made a mocking face.
But even you cannot fight majority away forever. Besides, your years have no meaning in this. You have seen and heard things that may be important. And Prince Joshua would want you there.
Would want?
Did he ask for me? The troll blew the hanging hair off his forehead impatiently.
Not with exactness, but he asked me, and I will take you. Joshua does not know all you have seen.
God's blood, Binnebik.
Please do not be swearing Adonite oaths at me, just because you are having a beard, almost. Does not make you a man to be cursing. Now please, let me have some silence to throw the bones. Then I have more news to tell.
Simon sat back, worried and upset.
What if they asked him questions? Was he going to be called to speak in front of barons and dukes and generals and all? He, a runaway scullion?
Binnebik was crooning softly to himself, gently shaking the bones like a trooper dicing in a tavern. They clicked and then tumbled free onto the slate floor. He examined their position, then scooped them up and tossed them twice more. He pursed his lips and stared intently at the last roll for some time.
Clouds in the pass, he said at last, musing. Wingless bird. Black crevice.
He rubbed his lips with the back of his sleeve, then thumped the heel of his hand once on his chest.
What am I to be making from such a tale?
Does it mean something? Simon asked. What are the words you just said?
They are the names for certain fallings, certain patterns. Three times we throw, and each throw means different.
Can you explain? Simon said,
then almost fell forward as Kantaka bowled past him to put her head on Binnebik's squat thigh.
Here, the troll said. First, clouds in the pass, meaning where we stand now it is hard to see far, but beyond is something very different. than what is behind.
I could have told you that.
Silence, trolling. Do you wish to remain foolish forever? Now, the one that is second was wingless bird. The second is something of advantage. But here it seems our helplessness might be itself useful. Or so I am reading the bones today. Last, what thing it is we should be aware of?
Or fear?
Or fear,
Benebik agreed calmly.
Black crevice. That is a strange one. One I never have gotten for myself. It could mean treachery.
Simon took a breath, remembering. Like false messenger.
True. But it is having other meanings, unusual meanings. My master taught me that it could also be things coming from other places, breaking through from other sides. That's perhaps something about the mysteries we have found. The Norns. Your dreams. Do you see?
A little. He stood up and stretched, then began looking for his shirt. What about the other news? It took the troll, who was meditatively stroking Kantaka's back, a moment to look up.
Ah, he said at last, and reached into his jacket. I have something for your reading.
He pulled out a flattened roll of parchment and handed it up. Simon felt his bare skin tingle. It was written in crisp but delicate script, a smattering of words in the midst of the unrolled sheet. For Simon, here are thanks for your bravery on our journey. May the good Lord always give you luck, friend. It was signed with the single letter M.
From her, he said slowly. He didn't know if he was disappointed or delighted.
It is from Maria, isn't it?
Is this all she sent? Did you see her?
Benebik nodded his head. He looked sad.
I saw her, but it was only of a moment. She said also that we would perhaps see her more, but there were things that must be done first.
What things? She makes me angry. No, I don't mean that. Is she here at Neglamond?
She gave me the message, did she not?
Benebik got unsteadily to his feet, but for the moment Simon was too consumed to pay much attention.
She had written. She had not forgotten.
But she certainly had not written much, and she hadn't come to see him, to talk, to do anything.
Oh, Siri, save me. Is this being in love?
He suddenly wondered. It was nothing like the ballads he had heard sung. This was more irritating than uplifting. He had thought he was in love with Hepzibah. He had certainly thought about her a great deal, but it had mostly been about the way she looked, she walked. With Maria, he certainly remembered how she looked, but just as much he wondered what she thought.
What she thinks,
he was disgusted with himself.
I don't even know where she comes from, let alone anything about how she thinks. I don't know the simplest thing about her.
And if she likes me, it's certainly not something she bothered to write in this letter. And that was only the truth, he knew.
But she said I was brave. She called me friend.
He looked up from the parchment to see Benebik staring at him. The troll's expression was morose, but Simon was not sure why.
Benebik,
he began, but then could think of no question whose answer would clear his muddy thoughts.
Well,
he said at last.
Do you know where the captain of the guard is? I have to get a sword.
The air was damp, and heavy grey skies hung over them as they walked to the outer ward. A pressing crowd of people streamed through the city gate, some bearing vegetables and flax and other things to sell, many pulling rickety carts that seemed to be heaped with the pitiful entirety of their worldly possessions. Simon's companions, the diminutive troll and the huge yellow-eyed wolf, made no small impression on these newcomers. Some pointed and cried out anxious questions in rustic dialect. Others shrank back, making the protective sign of the tree on their rough-suited breasts.
On all faces there were signs of fear. Fear of the different. Fear of the bad days that had come to work inland. Simon felt torn between wishing he could help them and wishing he did not have to see their homely, fretful faces. Binnebik left him at the guardhouse, part of the gate building of the outer ward, then went on to visit with Father Strangyard in the castle library. Simon quickly found himself before the captain of the guard, a drawn, harried-looking young man who was several days unshaven. He was bareheaded, his conical helm filled full of tally stones with which he was counting the muster of the outland militias trickling into the castle. He had been told to expect Simon, who was duly flattered the prince had remembered him, and handed the youth over to the ministrations of a bear-like, North Erkinlandish guardsman named Haston.
"Ain't got your growth yet, have ye?"
Haston growled, tugging his curly brown beard as he eyed Simon's lanky frame.
"A bowman, then, that's the story. Get ye a sword, we will, but 'twon't be big enough to do much. Bow's the thing."
Together they walked around the outer wall to the armory, a long narrow room behind the ringing smithy. As the arms warden led them down rows of battered armor and tarnished swords, Simon was saddened to see the dregs of the castle armaments, slim protection against the shining legions that Elias would no doubt put into the field.
"Not much left," Haston observed. "Weren't half enough in first place. Hope the outland levies bring somewhat beside pitchfork and ploughshare."
The limping warden at last found a scabbarded sword that the guardsman deemed to be of proper slenderness for Simon's size. It was crusty with dried oil, and the warden was hard put to mask his frown of distaste.
"Polish it," he said. "'Twill be a fine piece."
Further search turned up a longbow that lacked only a string, but was otherwise in good enough shape, and a leather quiver.
"Thriving's work,"
Haston said, pointing out the round-eyed deer and rabbits etched on the dark hide.
"Make fine quivers, Thriving's men do."
Simon had a feeling the guardsman felt a little guilty over the unprepossessing sword. Back at the guardhouse, his new tutor wheedled a bowstring and half a dozen arrows from the quartermaster, then showed Simon how to clean and care for his new weapons.
"Sharp it away, lad, sharp it away," the burly guardsman said, making the blade skitter across the whetstone. "Lest otherwise, you'll be a girl afore you're a man."
Somehow, against logic, he found a gleam of true steel beneath the tarnish and grit. Simon had hoped to start immediately with sword-wielding, or at least some target-shooting. But instead, Haston produced a pair of cloth-padded wooden poles and took Simon out the city gate to the hillside above the town. Simon quickly learned how little like real soldier sparring his play with Jeremiah's Chandler's boy had been.
"Spear work would be more use," Haston said,
as Simon sat on the turf wheezing over a buffet to the stomach.
"As 'tis, though, we've none to spare. That's why arrows be your game, boy. Still, it's nice to know some swording for close work. That's when you'll thank old Haston 100-fold.
"Why, not bow?" Simon panted.
"Tomorrow, boy, for bow and arrows, or day after."
Haston laughed and extended a broad paw.
"Get on your feet. Jolliness just started for the day."
Weary, sore, threshed like wheat until he thought he could feel the chaff trickling from his ears, Simon ate beans and bread at the guard's afternoon meal, while Haston continued the verbal part of his education, most of which Simon missed due to a low and continuous ringing in his ears. He was dismissed at last with a warning to be out sharp early the next morning. He stumbled back to Strangyard's empty room and fell asleep without even pulling off his boots. Rain spattered in through the open window, and thunder murmured in the distance. Simon woke to find Binnebik waiting for him, as he had that morning, as though the long, bruising afternoon had not occurred. That illusion was quickly dispelled when he sat upright. Every single muscle was stiff. He felt as though he were 100 years old. It took more than a little work for Binnebik to convince him to get off the bed.
"Simon, This is no evening of sport for your attending or declining. These are things on which our lives will hang balanced.
He had returned to his back.
I believe you, but if I get up, I'll die.
Enough!
The little man got hold of a wrist, braced his heels against the floor, wincing as he slowly tugged Simon back into a sitting position. There was a deep groan and a thump as one of Simon's booted feet hit the floor, then a long interval of silence before the second joined it. Long minutes later, he was limping out the door at Binnebik's side, into the gathering winds and chill rain.
"Will we have to sit through supper as well?" Simon asked.
For once in his life, he actually felt too sore to eat.
"That I do not think. Joshua is a strange one in that way. He is not for eating and drinking much with his court. He has a desire for solitariness. So, I am thinking, I'll have eaten before. That is indeed how I am reconciling Kantaka to staying in the room."
He smiled and patted Simon's shoulder. Simon winced.
"All that we will feast on this night will be worrying and arguing. Bad for digestion of troll, man, or wolf."
While the storm blustered loudly outside, the great hall of Naglimund was dry, warmed by three huge open hearths, lit by the flames of countless candles. The slanting beams of the roof disappeared in darkness high above, and the walls were thick with somber religious tapestries. Scores of tables had been pushed together into the shape of a vast horseshoe. Joshua's tall, narrow wooden chair stood at the apex of the ark, inscribed with the Swan of Naglimund. Already half a hundred men had installed themselves, at different points along the rim of the shoe, talking avidly among themselves. Tall men dressed in the furred robes and gaudy trinkets of petty nobility for the most part, but some wearing the rough gear of soldiers. Several looked up as the pair walked past, viewing them with appraising eyes, before turning back to their discussions. Binnebik elbowed Simon's hip.
"They are thinking, perhaps, that we are the hired tumblers,"
he laughed. But Simon did not think he looked truly amused.
"Who are all these people?"
Simon whispered as they sat down at the far end of one of the horseshoe's arms. A page set wine before them and added hot water before shrinking back into the long shadows of the wall.
"Lords of Erkinland, loyal to Naglimund and Joshua, or at least undecided as yet in their loyalties. The stout one in red and white is Ordmer, Baron of Utasol. He speaks with Grimstede, Ethelferth, and some other lords."
The troll hefted his bronze goblet and drank.
Our prince is not being profligate with his wine. Or perhaps it is that he wishes appreciation for the fine local water."
Binnebik's mischievous smile reappeared. Simon slid back in his chair, fearing a similar reappearance of the small, sharp elbow, but the small man only looked past him up the table. Simon took a long swallow of his wine. It was watery. He wondered whether it was the seneschal or the prince himself who was tight with a fitting piece. Still, it was better than nothing, and might serve to ease his aching limbs. When he finished, the page scurried forward and filled it again. More men trickled in, some animatedly conferring, others coolly surveying those who had already arrived. A very, very old man, in sumptuous religious robes, entered on the arm of a husky young priest and began to set up various shiny articles near the head of the table. The look on his face was one of definite bad temper. The younger man helped him into a chair and then leaned down and whispered something into his ear. The elder made a reply of seemingly dubious civility. The priest, with a long-suffering glance at the roof beams, strode from the room.
"Is that the lector?"
Simon asked in hushed tones. Binnebik shook his head.
"It seems very doubtful to me that the head of your whole Edonite church would be here in the den of an outlaw prince. Likely that is Anodis, the bishop of Naglimund."
As Binnebik spoke,
A last clutch of men came in, and the troll broke off to watch. Some, with hair in slender braids down their backs, wore the belted white tunics of the Hernisteri. Their apparent leader, an intense, muscular young man with long, dark moustaches, was talking to a southerner of some kind, an exceedingly well-dressed fellow who appeared only slightly older. This one, hair carefully curled, robed in delicate shades of heather and blue, was so neatly turned out that Simon felt sure even Sangfugl would be impressed. Some of the old soldiers around the table were openly grinning at the foppishness of his rig.
"And these?" Simon asked. "The ones in white, with the gold round their necks. Hernisteri, yes? Correct. Prince Gwythyn, that is, and his embassy. The other, my guessing is, would be Baron Devasalis of Naban. He has reputation as a sharp wit, if a bit full of fondness for costume. A brave fighter, too, I was told."
"How do you know all this, Binnabek?" Simon asked, turning his attention from the newcomers back to his friend.
"Do you listen at keyholes?"
The troll drew himself up haughtily.
"I do not live always on mountaintops, you know. Also, I have found Strangyard and other resources here, while you have been at keeping your bed warm."
"What?" Simon's voice came out louder than he had intended it to. He realized he was at least a little drunk. The man seated beside him turned with a curious glance. Simon leaned forward to continue his defense in a quieter tone.
"I have been," he began.
Then chairs began creaking all over the hall as their occupants suddenly stood. Simon looked up to see the slender figure of Prince Joshua, dressed in his customary gray, enter at the hall's far end. His expression was calm but unsmiling. The only indication of his rank was the silver circlet on his brow.